I can't do it.
I'm just asking.
You can't.
No, can't.
Ooga chaka, ooga chaka, ooga 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 chaka, ooga chaka. Welcome to WWNYLXX Radio, the home for the New York Linux scene. Here from our lovely studios with the lovely look of Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn, New York. And today, we happen to be pretty lucky because today we are having an install fest, which means we have a bunch of people here today, and we're going to hopefully rotate in and out some of our guests from the New York Linux scene, including some students and board members and various other things. And we have an exciting day because we're all getting ready to go tomorrow to... We're getting ready to go tomorrow to Washington, D.C., which means at 4 o'clock in the morning tomorrow we are going to be heading down to Washington, hopefully not to get ourselves in any sort of trouble with anybody, dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Our favorite Revolutionary War soldier is probably going to be my friend Vinny. In any event, in preparation for that, we have already our costumes, and thanks to Ray for helping us with that. Mr. Microsoft Crack. And then we have, in addition to that, we got our van, also thanks to Ray. And hopefully Joe Gustero will show up sometime. Joe, if you're out there, we're expecting you. Don't forget about us, because we're all supposed to be going out tomorrow morning. And we've had an exciting week this week, in case anybody hasn't noticed. Not once, but twice this week, we were supposed to have a deal with our good friend, Mr. Brett Winkoop, and our good friend, Mr. Jay Sulzberger, in order to get back our intellectual property, although I hate to use that term, specifically our .org domain from them, in a deal in which we would give them the rights to doing NY Fair Use, which we'll peel off to them, and we'll just create a new name for our organization of NY Fair Use. However, as simple as it sounds, it seems to have become very complicated. We'll leave it at that. At this point, if you want to know more, you can go to the main WWW.NYLXS page, and we can talk about something. Let's see, a little bit more exciting about some of the events of the week. Let's see. One of the things that has happened in the last few weeks, if not this week actually, was the FCC had received literally thousands of requests from ISPs across the country, about 7,000 or more, requesting not to hand over packet switching to the baby bells. The result of that was is that they were ignored, and that means that your DSL and broadband width is going to be, in the next few months, probably reduced or removed from underneath you from DSL. DSL is going to be legally dead in this country in a few months. We can thank our congressman for that, and we can thank our basic lack of political spirit in becoming involved in these things. Of course, this is a very critical thing for free software, our ability to put our systems up on the web and to share information without being spied on. And, of course, in order to do that, we need to be able to have access to the Internet. And broadband, as our friend David Sugar would tell you, has been built into the phone system basically since the mid-60s. And in Brooklyn, in this area, we can just drop a fiber basically from my backyard to my house, and we can get almost unlimited amount of broadband width if we wanted to very cheaply, maybe 50 cents or an hour or less. The telephone company just refuses to do this. They are what's blocking broadband. Now, why is this important besides the obvious reasons? The first reason why it's important is for the obvious reason, which means that if the telephone company could put a squash on the ability for competition for broadband and for ISPs, then the net result of that is that the innovation for the Internet dies. The second reason why this is important, though, is because politically, Jack Valenti, our friend Jack Valenti, from the Motion Picture Industry of America, has said that the reason why we don't have broadband yet being accepted in the United States is because there's no movies. And the reason why there's no movies is because there's not enough DRM. And this is the logic that they've been trying to push. Now, when we were down, when New Yorkers for Fair Use went down there, led by me, to Washington, D.C., we made it quite clear We tried to make it quite as clear as we could that this was hogwash. The reason why there's no broadband is because the damn phone companies are in our way. Get the phone companies out of the loop, and broadband becomes a reality tomorrow. As it is, by the way, in Korea and Japan and in Germany. In fact, one of the reasons why you get so much spam from Korea is because Korea has unlimited broadband access at a very cheap price. And that's the way that is. In New York, we don't have that kind of luck. Now, this is a political tactic where you blame situation A for situation B, even though that situation B is completely unrelated. In the lexicon of street talk, this is called a red herring, right? Where we just run something up the flagpole to see if it sticks. It shouldn't stick. It's up to you to actually write your congressman and tell him that this is not acceptable and that we need to reverse this. First, they tried to get this through the legislative branch of government, and they completely failed. And this is the problem with playing whack-a-mole. So instead of concentrating on making sure that we had a bill that proactively guaranteed our rights to this infrastructure, we went over and we just played whack-a-mole. And then we went over and we decided, okay, what we'll do is we'll fight the FCC when it's the FCC's turn, and then they failed, right? The proactive way of doing this is using your representative to represent you, which is having them write a bill which would effectively defend you against abuses. The same thing is true, of course, for digital rights management. Digital rights management is going to continue to crop up in hundreds of places. We can't possibly track them all down. We don't have the kind of money to do that or the resources to do it. We need to make it a legislative agenda so that proactively our fair use rights are guaranteed to us. This is one of the reasons why we're going down to Washington, D.C. Which brings us up to Washington. The reason why we're going down to Washington is because the kind of thinking that has allowed us to slide backwards like this and play whack-a-mole and do various other things, it's an attitude that says, let's all get along and play along. This is not politics. Politics does not work like that. This is not the way it is in unions. This is not the way it is in the PTA. This is not the way it is in Congress. When you have a congressman, you have an issue. One side is for it. Another side is against it. One side wins. One side doesn't win. And that's the way it is. When you have an issue that's important, you have to choose your side. You have to fight for your side unilaterally and not give up on it. It's really that simple. So I'd like to, now that we got all that stuff out of the way, introduce to my left one of our members, Ray Conley. And Ray, while we're at it, how do you spell your name?
My last name, there's various spellings of Connolly. Mine is Connolly.
Okay, great.
Just two O's, two N's, two L's.
Got it. That's why I can't spell it. As well as I can't spell anything else. I'm not even sure how it's pronounced anymore because all those L's and O's and stuff, it's moving around. Okay. Ray was, Ray's an interesting guy. Ray was a stock broker. He made a small fortune in stocks at one point, won it and lost it, of course. And he lives in the wonders of East Chelsea in Manhattan, where all the young people stay these days. I was going to say something else, but I won't.
I'm actually on the east side. Chelsea's on the west. I'm in Stuyvesant Town.
In Stuyvesant Town, which is actually not far from where I was working when I was at NYU.
Yes, plenty of NYU buildings in that area.
Well, actually, I was right across the street from Stuyvesant Town. I was on 23rd and or 24th and Lex, of course, from the VA. In any event, Ray had the wonderful experience of taking our Linux One class.
That's true.
So what we'd like to do a little bit about today is talk about the Free Software Institute and its importance to the community. And we'd like to talk to Ray, because Ray comes from a non-computing background, took our class, decided that he would investigate free software and see how it can work for him. And he's also taking a very big initiative at this point in helping us organize our Free Software Chamber of Commerce, which is moving right along and is making some headway at this point. But before we get to the Free Software Chamber of Commerce, so tell us, what was your experience with the classes? Which class did you take, first of all? And
did
you take?
Let me start from the beginning. I purchased a computer in late 1998 from Dell, of course, preloaded with Windows 98. And I wasn't totally intrigued with computing and tried to get into and under the hood of Windows 90 as much as possible. And the harder I looked and the further I tried to dig, the more I realized that I just wasn't allowed to dig. And that even though this was my computer and I had spent my hard-earned money on it, and spent my hard-earned money on the software to run on that computer, there was an awful lot of stuff that I was just flat-out not allowed to do. And if there were certain files I could get into, it was such arcane gibberish that I couldn't make it head of tails from it. The last straw, so to speak, was when I was clearing out some infamous index.dat files, which are basically just data files on the Windows machine that I, as the sole owner and administrator of the machine, did not have permission to not look at or remove or alter in any way, shape, or form. And being a freedom-loving American, I just thought that was completely unacceptable. I had earned the money to buy the machine. I had spent the money to buy the machine and all the software on it, and it was rightfully mine, and just found it unacceptable that I could not do what I want with it, even if that was destroy it or break it. And so I started to look for alternatives, and I came across Linux was just not even a buzzword at that time. It was still a little bit under the radar, most people, and I just grew infatuated with it, and kind of on a late version, late 6-point-something version, maybe 7.0 of Red Hat, and I threw that on a spare computer that I had, and it just worked wonderfully, actually, and everything at the very core was written in C, which I could figure out with just another book to buy, and I just thought that was the most amazing thing, and truly the way I thought it really should be. And from there, I set up, I bought a new computer, which I built from scratch. As much as I liked my Dell, I was just getting more and more into the whole computing environment, and I decided to use the internet to buy every little piece of the computer myself and put it all together myself and truly build my own box with exactly the specs that I wanted. And sure, sugar, Linux was going on that box. So I decided to run both Windows and Linux concurrently because I still did most of my computing off of Windows. But that would not be for long, because once I had the Linux up and running, I realized there's really nothing I can't do on Linux that Microsoft would have me believe that they can't do on Windows. And I started slowly migrating over to Windows, from Windows into Linux. And as this point, I have been fully Linux used, Linux based.
GNU-Linuxized.
Yeah. GNU, I was totally GNU Linux based now since about mid 2000. And frankly, there is not one thing there's nothing I can't do on my Linux box that the Windows world tells me that I need Windows for. And one of my greatest kicks is I often play Text Twister on Yahoo Games. And all you have to do is read a web page or two and get Java installed on your Linux box and link into the set up the plugin for Mozilla. And Text Twist will run magnificently. It's a Java-based game on Yahoo. And I get a great kick out of it because right at the foot of the game it says, this game will not work on Macintosh or Linux-based computers. And I just get a great chuckle out of that because I play it very often on my 100% GNU Linux free software system.
Okay, let me ask you a question. When did you decide that you needed a more formalized approach to your education of the system?
Well, that corresponds right in line. When I started, as I mentioned earlier, I love the fact that I could get so deep under the hood where everything was just plain old source code written in English language and everything else. So I decided, okay, I want to definitely take this route. I want to be able to get and utilize the true power of my computer, which is not pointing and clicking, but actually writing scripts and codes and make the actual machine do specifically what I wanted. Not what a vendor decides what I want. It tells me what to do. And I just decided, all right, I need a starting place, and what better place to start with was with Linux. And I knew C was a little bit further down the road for me, but I need to start from the beginning. So I pumped into Google, New York, and Linux, and a couple of sites came up, and Nylog was one, and NYLXS was another. And I went onto the website of NYLXS, and I was fully intrigued because it focused where Nylog was more Linux and user group, the Linux user group. NYLXS website articulated very eloquently on how the group was all about Linux users and using the system and free software, but there was a special factor to the group that they felt made it stand out higher up among the rest, and that was the focus on leadership and building leadership. And to me, that was very intriguing because I think that's a very important thing in our society, especially this day and age. We as Americans seem to be very complacent these days, and people need to get involved. And
you know, it's very interesting that you say that. Americans can at sometimes be lulled into complacency, and of course, from the days of James Dean, you know, in the 50s, there's always been this thing about children or not children. I guess at 40, turning 40 this month, I could say
have
children. But youngsters, many of whom I wouldn't mind dating, so I shouldn't call them children, rebel against what they would consider a complacency. In the 50s, there wasn't that much of a suburban deal yet. You know, it was just beginning to be built. And yet, it was already, you know, clearly, at that point, a backlash against complacency. And today, it's even more so the case where, as the country seems to get more and more cookie-cuttered out, you know, strip mall after strip mall, suburban enclave again, and a suburban enclave, we have a pop culture that seems to be getting more and more rebellious and more violent. In any event, it seems that Linux in New York is natural. More than
absolutely, because
more than California, and I think there's a big, and it's happened, I've noticed it over the last few weeks, there's a big difference between the culture of the Linux users in California and the Linux users in New York. The Linux users in California are, in some degree, is very intellectual in their approach. And New Yorkers, we don't have what you would call in Yiddish the zitzfleisch for this. In other words, we don't have the patience for this. We are a much more aggressive society in New York, and Linux is good for that.
Yeah. Another important fact, I think, is that I'm born and raised in Brooklyn, and I've been living in Manhattan for a good 10 or 12 years now, and I have a lot of family in California. But there's an inherent freedom that New Yorkers enjoy that is probably the only place in the country where you can enjoy certain freedoms. And the freedom is to walk out your door and have over 10,000 restaurants in front of you, to never have to own a car, to be able to travel from the Pelham Park on the very tip top of the Bronx all the way out to Far Rockaway to some of the most beautiful beaches in the world, all for $1.50, soon be $2, but still that has got to be the best transportation bargain in the country. And there's just an inherent freedom to this city that comes from a lot of factors that you don't find anywhere else in the country. And, you know, California, as much as I do love California, there is a lot of restrictions in California when it comes to getting around and certain things like that. But New York, I mean, it's truly the city never sleeps, and there's always something to do no matter where you are. The freedom is always there for you to go out and enjoy the city. And that goes hand in hand with the Linux system, in my belief, in that I want to be able to do with my computer what I want, and GNU Linux is really the only system that allows me to do that.
So this made you aware of the classes. What was your
right? So I
went
to the website.
What was the first class that you took?
First class, I stumbled on the FSI also on that website, and I love the fact that focused on it. I mean, I had looked into certain classes, looking at the computer, some of the computer rags around, and all these classes were in thousands of dollars. And, you know, I have my bachelor's degree, and I've paid the thousands of dollars for courses, and I know that there's nothing like real life. And some of these trade schools, I just were very wary about them all. And on the website at the NYLXS, it was focused on quality and quality and price as well. In fact, that it was cheap enough to take to take many classes, and there was no sacrifice in quality or in depth. And so I decided, well, look, let me take the first step. And I went down to some of the meetings, and I decided went down to the meetings down at Colony Rose, down near Wall Street, where I've worked for years, and just met some of the people, because I think that's the best way to go down and you know, see what you're kind of getting into. And I just knew right away these people here that care an awful lot about the system and the ramifications it has for the greater good of a lot of people and society in general. And obviously it was very clear that they were well knowledged in the system and in computing in general. So I decided I'd give it a shot. It's an excellent price class, and really I thought it was a, compared to some of the other classes and prices that went along with it, I just thought it was a wonderful opportunity. And at the very least, I thought if, you know, worst case scenario, I'd much rather take this chance than on some of these other trade schools you see in the rags that are just shady at best, in my opinion.
Let me ask, so what was your impression of the...
So I went down to, I did take some computing courses in college, and I was fully impressed with the GNU Linux 1. It was the first class I took, which was on Tuesday nights, ran from 7 to 11, which I think was a wonderful amount of time, because some of these other classes I saw were only an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and it's just not enough. You need to get in, settled in, get a discussion going, and then you need to actually get in front of a computer and tap away. So I was... What impressed me the most right off the bat was we started at with a hard drive. You don't get, you know, any more bare bones than that, and you get a...
Okay. I have a little bit of advantage, and you do too, because yeah, we went through the program and I teach it, but or that particular class anyway. But okay, the first day you sit down into the class, and what was your expectation?
Well, I really didn't know. I didn't know what to expect, but I was open-minded about it, and, you know, I expected... Definitely knowledgeable people, and I expected some quality, and but again, I did not know what to expect. And 5 minutes into it, I was thoroughly impressed, because, as I said, I had taken some computer courses, and here I was learning stuff.
So your expectation was that you were open to just about anything happening at this point.
Correct.
You had a description, so you didn't know that the class was going to cover a certain...
Yes, that it was the basic fundamentals of Linux.
So the first thing that happened in the class on the first day, you say that the instructor pulls out a hard drive, right?
An actual physical opened hard drive, so you can see all the workings. You see the disks. You see the arm and the head of the arm. Something I had never seen before, because everything is so locked up and sealed up, you know, as it has been. It's very delicate technology inside there.
And was there a point to this besides the gee whiz effect, or did it make a point that was...
Yeah, because that is the stepping stone, and from there you start to learn what constitutes that disk, what's on that physical disk that the arm is reading from. Is it just a silver platter? No. What is it? It's you know, it's a collection of inodes. And why? What's an inode? You get into that, and that is the basic building blocks. And from there, it very methodically built upon those very blocks, those beginning blocks, step by step, and until the point where you knew the entire innards of the machine, both hardware and software.
Well, I don't want to oversell that we teach everything there is know about hardware, because it's not the focus of the class.
Well, not good.
But we do try to teach the fundamentals so that you understand what we're trying to do. Is the GNU Linux class it's largely surrounded by, but not exclusively, trying to teach I'm sort of having two conversations here.
Well, yeah, it builds on. I mean, you know, I don't mean the entire hardware system. If you, you know, there are various courses, and if you're focusing on one area of the system that utilizes some sort of hardware, you have to understand the hardware in order to understand how the software is going to work with that hardware and how it's going to interact with that.
Right. That was the point. That was exactly the point. I mean, you're installing something on a computer, and unfortunately, the first thing in learning how to deal with your system is getting over the fear factor of what is this machine and what does it do. And so when we created it, we tried to present that this is a device just as a door might be a device.
I think the example you used was a light switch, and that is as basic as it gets, and it takes some of the fear factor out of it. Makes it more normal.
That's it. So you can actually envision that when you are doing the install, hopefully, that you understand that when you run FDisk, the drive is actually doing certain steps that you can physically understand how that relates to the physical apparatus of the machine. And I think it's successful. I mean, do you think that you would have been able to get this information in a different way as effectively?
No, I don't. I mean, I went to a not a cheap college, and I did take some beginner computer courses, and I never got any of that information from them.
Okay, so the first day, basically, you walk into the class, and the instructor picks up a hard drive and says, "This, my dear, is a hard drive." But what is it about the hard drive that you learned that day that was new, that you had not really thought about previously? Hints, especially like when the instructor turns over and shows you the chips.
That the hard drive in and of itself is a computer, and that the actual box that you bring home from the store is actually a collection of computers all working together to form your system. The actual hard drive itself is its own computer, has its own chips, it's doing its own stuff.
Okay, that's excellent. So there was a discussion of computers in the general, right?
That's correct.
Good. Now, as the quest continued on, what other topics were covered that you felt that were important? Like in the installation process itself, what was done for you that would not have been previously been able to get in from books in terms of how to install and so on? How did it change the way you think about the installation process?
One of the one things that jumped out at me was, again, going back to this fear factor thing. I had very cautiously danced around FDisk for the year or 2 years that I played with computers prior. And I'd say by this second class, I was F-disking myself all over the place, moving, setting up my partition tables and everything else all by hand. And it was great sense of empowerment there, figuring, being able to utilize all that. And that would lead into my next thing was the actual layout of the disk. I was so used to the C drive, and just lump everything on there, and you have to... if you wanted to reboot, you got to wipe the whole thing and start from scratch. And here I'm learning about partition tables and certain areas of the operating system that will go in certain areas of the hard disk and its own partitions, and how everything is protected from failure against, failures in other areas. And even if there is an install or something to that effect, something to that effect needed, that your data and your personal information can be protected on its own partition, and that the reinstall only has to be reinstalled on a particular partition that the actual OS, the actual operating portion of the software is, the guts of it all.
Okay, so now with these new systems that you have that are GUIized, right, the installation mm-hmm. process, do you feel that the lessons that you've learned by doing it, so to speak, in a broken down methodology?
Absolutely, because it's not as abstract anymore. I'm not just pointing and clicking. I actually know what's going on. I actually, all the choices in the GUI, I mean, I know what all the choices really are.
So what are those fundamental steps that is required to install the GNU Linux operating system, as well as any other for that matter?
Mm-hmm.
That was the question. What are those steps?
what are the fundamental steps?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first is you go back to a scratch pad and you scratch out and lay out your disc on the on a piece of paper and what you want on your disc. Personally, I don't run any servers at home, so I don't my layout would be a little different. That we did a server in the class, so it was a little bit more in depth on the as far as partition goes. But I separate my home. I separate some multimedia stuff that I have. I separate. I have a multi-user system with other family members on it. They all get their own little portion.
Okay, but let's just look at the installation process itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing you do, obviously, is what? You turn the power on, right, to your computer, right? Power goes
yes.
into your machine. Then what happens?
And the kernel is loaded into RAM.
So where does that kernel come from?
It's either come the floppy or a bootable CD-ROM, which is, at this point, I'm still using a floppy drive.
Okay. So you turn the machine on, which has no operating system on. It's just an empty, naked computer at this point, right?
Correct.
And the disk goes in there, and the kernel comes up. It's read from the disk somehow.
Read from the disk somehow.
Into RAM.
Into RAM, correct.
Okay. So obviously the first thing has to happen is that the media, the boot media that you're using has to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The second step is that then the kernel gets, or it doesn't have to be, it doesn't even have to be the same kernel, right? It can be any kernel.
It can be any kernel.
As long as it can do the basic instructions as necessary, right?
Correct. It okay. could be heard for that matter.
In fact, in the original Slackware distributions, it was Minix.
Okay.
Just as a matter of fact. In fact, you can use Linux to install Windows if you so choose to. Don't ask me why you'd want to do that, but you can do that. all right, so the kernel goes back, and then it does what? Then it identifies what? The kernel itself reads the hardware, right?
Correct. Goes to, reads, checks for your hard disk, and then it's the inode?
Well, there's no inodes yet.
There's no inodes at this. It accesses the hard disk and starts to form a data table on that hard disk.
That's okay. So once it's up, though, there's yet nothing happening, right? You have no hard drive, right?
Correct.
So it's at this point that you have to do what?
You have to actually get the system to partition the hard drive.
Partition the hard drive. Okay.
Correct.
All right. But okay. So when you partition the hard drive, you have a that doesn't yet put anything onto the drive, right?
No.
Okay. So then what would be the next step?
I know.
What would be the next step?
But laying out
the file system.
With the file system, absolutely.
Okay. And what is a file system?
The file system is a collection of inodes.
It's a database of inodes.
A database
right?
of inodes, yes.
Okay. All right, so once you lay down the file system, right, on your partitions, then at this point, then you can do what?
You can start to install the operating system.
Which means transferring, copying somehow binary packages.
Correct, from your install media onto your hard drive.
Onto your hard drive, okay. This is good. So this is basically, it doesn't really matter where your install media is, right? Your install
no,
media could be...
Could be anywhere. Could be on the network.
Could be on the network. That's very good. Okay, then after you have your packages installed, and you basically have that image of operating system on your system, what would be the next step?
Of the install?
Yeah. So you lay down, you have all your packages down now, and your
okay,
partition's
you're all
done, right?
Yes.
So if you turn the machine off now, then what happens?
Well, no, you can't just turn it off. You have to install a master boot record. You have to be able to utilize the machine to actually boot itself up without the boot media and without the initial media in
right.
there.
And basically the tool for that would be Willow these days.
Willow is moving towards Grub, yes.
Yeah, I'm not happy with that myself. But anyway, all right. Now, so now the machine reboots, right?
Correct.
So was that the entire class? Did it just stop with that, okay, where you have an operating system now?
No, absolutely not. We then get into software. and configuring your network and file systems, and I mean it touches on a lot of fundamental things in the operating system. Okay. Start to get familiar with the terminal, basic commands in the Linux system.
Did you look at how the system actually boots?
Yes, we did.
So we also covered then the sequence of how System 5 systems and BSD type systems kick off their initiation processes. It's pretty good. And how long did it take you to cover all this material?
This was over 6 weeks, I think it was. 4 hours, one night a week, 4 hours each night for a six-week run. And it ended with a recompile, which...
A recompile of what?
A recompile of the kernel, which I might add, I tackled a couple times through books and just
bored you
failed, basically. I would bang my head against it a couple of times. I even bought a book that says Linux for Windows users, and really there's no substitution for a hands-on recompile. Because it is, I mean, a lot of it had to do with the fear factor. Because reading a book, unfortunately a lot of books, first thing they say is back up everything, and you know, they have their reasons for doing that, and I don't debate that, but it does strike a bit of fear into you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have someone there to handhold you through it, walk you through it, once you get on the other end of it, you realize, hey, this isn't all that difficult. I can do this. I know what's going on. I know why things are going on. And I know why, you know, the little Z is on at the end of VM Linux now, and things like that would puzzle me, and it's... There's just so much information out here about the system that a lot of times it's a lot of work just to figure it out, where the information is.
Okay, can I ask, was it all classroom work, or was there something that was done?
No, the classrooms are held in basically in the lab, so you're sitting in front of a computer the entire time. So you're not just hearing a lecture.
Who's
and
computer?
Then... Your own computer.
So you purchased your own computer?
I did. I purchased a Walmart computer for $180 without an OS. And I ended up loading SUSE 8.1 Professional on there in under an hour.
In under an hour. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
For $200. That's awfully good.
It was excellent. It's a great little box for it. I mean, it doesn't have the functionality that you want for... Industrial use or anything like that, but that's not what that's
nothing to laugh at.
That's not the one. That's not what it's for. Exactly, it's an excellent machine, and in fact, I have my brother now using that machine. He's running. It's funny because I use KDE, and I didn't give him any choice. I basically threw him in the fire with Linux when I overwrote my Windows 2000 machine. He had no choice but to make the migration with me. And I pointed out to him that there were all different kinds of window managers and stuff like that. And sure, sugar, he is now an avid GNOME user. And I'm a KDE user. And he's not even, that much of a digithead. I am. But he loves playing around with it. And I think it's just the freedom that he had, that he enjoys... in comparison to the Windows world, where they tell you, this is the way it should look and this is the way it's going to look.
That is nice. That is nice. It's a great story. I would like to add that the class, when it graduates, has an install fest. In fact, tonight was an install fest for the latest GNU Linux class.
That is correct.
In which we did quite a few installations. Now, unfortunately, because of the weather today being the first really warm day on a Sunday that we've seen in a long time, I think that a lot of people who would have normally liked to turn up didn't show up. However, the last time we did the install fest was actually your class, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I recall, you and Sesklo were in that class together.
That's correct. We had that
and
at King's Games.
We had King's Games down the block over here in Kingside. Yeah. We had a great time. I remember we were there
packed.
Until about 4 in the morning.
4 in the morning, yeah.
Almost.
Many a pizza was devoured.
They kept us, the place stayed open for us, essentially, because they just enjoyed us being enjoyed. The thing is, though, that you guys tackled a very sophisticated machine that I personally didn't want to be involved in installing, mm-hmm. I remember. Do you recall?
I don't. You know what? I was intrigued by, there was a gentleman came down with a IBM ThinkPad, and we installed Red Hat 8, which was just released at the time, over the network on a PCI card,
mm-hmm.
if I'm pronouncing that acronym right.
PCMCI. Do you recall that little Fujitsu piece of hardware the guy brought in at the like at the last minute that kept us there until almost 4 in the morning? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
Remember, you and Cisco hacked that, and Chris Walker was there also, if I remember, right? And there was this little machine that had touch screen, and it was like a laptop, and in order to install it, you guys had to remove the hard drive from it and get a boot disk off the net.
Okay, yeah, I remember that. I remember Celso ripping the hard drive right. out of there.
I remember.
Since I was working on the network drive, we said, well, let's try the boot off the network.
Yes, I remember. Yes. I was really impressed because you guys essentially came out of the class. You came into the class knowing very little. You came out of the class. This guy brings in the most oddball piece of hardware I've ever seen. Fortunately, he had a bootable device. I was in doubt that was going to happen. And then when you did that, you guys managed to analyze the hardware for that thing, get the necessary drivers for SUSE to boot the hardware correctly, boot the hardware, install a core system, and then came back after you got the core system up, and then brought back all the advanced modules for the X-windowing system and everything. And you even got
the touch screen going, ATM style.
Right. You guys went over and researched on the internet what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed because...
Yeah, it falls along the true hacker spirit, too. It was just a collection of minds saying, what about this? Why don't we do this? Everyone kicking in a little bit. Next thing you know, the problem is tackled.
It was amazing. It was really a very unusual piece of hardware, and I was highly impressed. I would not have been able to, I don't think, install it by myself. When he brought it in, I just looked the other way. I didn't want anything to do with it, as a matter of fact. There's a tendency at InstallFest that people bring in these strange things. Can you install
just hand it
Red
over
Hat
to
8 like, yeah, on my Windows 3.8 system? Or on my 386 system, and you're like, no.
It doesn't. I love getting it on the Liberato too. I think that's the
Liberato. Yes.
The wonderful little.
Anyway, overall though, it was a very positive experience. I think.
Absolutely, it was a wonderful experience.
Are you planning on taking other classes?
I am. I actually took I took Unix 1 after that.
Which was taught by who?
That was Marco Sofia, taught the Unix 1.
Oh, we don't get a chance to sing the praises of Marco too often. How was that?
That was wonderful, that class. That was, I think I spent maybe $100 worth of just on textbooks after and during that class. The Unix programming environment by Richie and Kerrigan, which is, you know, from the 70s. I tore through that book, Unix Power Tools, all these great little tools. That was the book that really opened up this whole system to me on a real cerebral level, because I really started to get the whole theory and the whole the base of thinking behind the Unix system as a toolbox and as a collection of tools, that the true power isn't in these little tools in the box. It's the collection of tools and the way you can use them and the way you can intertwine them and mix them and get incredibly powerful results, things that you would never have heard of. I mean, I remember I have quite an extensive MP3 collection, and all I really wanted was a list of all my files. And for the life of me, I could not get my Windows 98 to list out those files. Every time I tried to cut and paste all the names or anything of that sort, it would try and copy the entire file. Now, with Linux, it took, you know, two commands that were basically one command. And I added myself a nifty little text file with all my titles printed out. And it's funny because I have a friend of mine who is a Linux enthusiast, but he is a head sysadmin in a Windows shop, so he's in a very windowed world. And I was laughing at him about that problem. And he was telling me that that's something that DOS would have done, but you know, Microsoft seemed to have forgotten all about that. They've taken DOS out of their systems, and he goes, that would have been an easier problem to do in Windows 15 years ago than it is today.
Are you going to take another class?
Yes, I was. I am looking to take Linux 2. GNU Linux 2 is on my list. I know it has just started up, though, but I am going to wait for the next rotation on that one. And I will eventually go from there. After that, Unix 2, I think, is the next after that, and then I'll get into Perl. And then, see, I tried to set this course. I wanted to build, you know, start a building block. So I started at the very basic with Linux 1. I had already known a lot about Linux. I had thought when I started up, and I took the GNU Linux 1 class, and I'm glad I did take it because I learned an awful lot. And I just kind of set out a course of a curriculum that I wanted to follow, and that was to build on that, was the Linux 1 and the Unix 1, get into Linux 2, which gets into the more of the applications that are running, such as Apache and stuff like that, and then Unix 2. And then once I had a solid understanding of the actual system, and then I could devote some time into actual programming and scripting and stuff like that.
Let me ask you one other question while we're on topic. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the FSI, the Free Software Institute, although we have a pleasure of teaching people the nuts and bolts of programming and so on, I believe that, you know, the first day of class, I always say that the purpose of this class, why it's education, is not just to teach you about computers, but to teach you about the politics and the issues that are important to these systems. Did you find that was an impedance to your classes, or did it enhance your experience?
No, I thought it was an enhancement. Going back to some of my original comments, was that the system is really embedded within the system is the freedom and the encouragement to learn and to explore and to use the system in new ways that are unique to yourself and the ways you want it. And this is some of getting back to my original comments, was the original motivation, because I just got so frustrated with my Windows machine saying, you, the system administrator, are not allowed to do that. And as a New Yorker, it pissed me off. Who is to say that I can't, you know, do what I want with my machine? I understand that it's dumbed down for a lot of people, and it's in order to protect it so people don't destroy it. But I had I was a full privileged administrator on that machine. And
so when you cracked open that box and you brought it into the classroom the first day, it must have given you a real feeling of empowerment right there.
Entirely.
I had found that was unexpected. I always wanted them to have their own boxes so they can use it as guinea pigs throughout the entire program. But the first time that they opened up those boxes, it was mm-hmm. a mixture between the kids on Christmas morning and, not that I would have any experience with that, or and an empower of electricity and empowerment that just zips through the entire class at that point. Once those machines crack open,
right.
They turn them on and they're just dead, you know, and you get nothing but that BIOS prompt. It's very, you
well,
feel
yeah.
you
know,
their
I think the
silence.
Microsoft marketing machine would have the world just be so dumbed down that they can, you know, kind of dictate to everybody.
Yeah, the students right away took possession of those machines. Okay, I'd like to now take a 3-minute breather and bring in another one of our former students that we've had in Mr. Vinny. And give him a chance to say hello and for him to tell a little bit about his experiences with the Free Software Institute. Okay. Back.
Thanks for having me. It was
minutes.
Great.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Anytime.
Hello, welcome back to www.nylxradio.com.
Okay.
This is Ruben Safer again, present but not future president of NYLXS. Probably will still continue to do the radio show unless Marco decides to get his own voice. We are bringing into our offices now another one of our important members, Vincenzo. Vincenzo, like one word, like chair.
That's it.
There you go. Vinny was an interesting guy. We met Vinny through our class. By the way, a lot of the members for NYLXS come through the classes, which is really says something about the type of camaraderie that we develop in these classes. This last class I was very happy with because it seemed to have developed a very good sense of camaraderie, and I'm pleased as Dickens with the new people that we have brought into the organization with this last round of classes. Vinny was one of our earlier students, predated even Ray, I think, at this point. Vinny should be pretty much of a pro at this point. About a year ago. Were you in Liz's class originally? Were you in the first Pro 1 class or the first 1X1 class?
Liz was in the class.
Liz was in the class. Joe Gostero was in that class. Paul Rodriguez was in that class.
Yeah, yeah.
Our whole board was in that class.
That was the class.
That was the class of a lifetime. We did really good with that class. In any event, Vinny, what did you know before you took that Linux? Was that the Linux one or the Pro one?
That was Linux one.
What did you know about?
Well, I had been running Mandrake for a few months, I believe. Well, let's see, that was about a year ago. Yeah, I had been running Mandrake for a few months, and I wanted to get more knowledge with Linux. I saw right away that it was something that I would prefer over Windows, and I just wanted to learn more about it.
Okay, so how did you find out about our GNU Linux program?
Because
we did not meet before that class, for sure. In fact, you just seemed almost drop out of the sky.
Yeah, actually, I did. Someone had mentioned something about NYLXS at a... I had gone to an install fest at VA... Used to be VA Linux.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it's VA Software. Is it still VA Software now?
Whatever they are. Whatever Larry says they are.
I went to a install fest at VA Software, and I had heard good things then about NYLXS. So I took a look at the website, and then I sent you an email. You remember that email?
No.
Yeah.
You have to
this is how you're going to remember that email. I made an analogy between purchasing the server and purchasing scuba gear.
Okay, I don't remember. Believe it or not, I don't remember. You'll have to excuse me. I get about 400 or 500 emails a day, and most of them about nonsense. But anyway, the first class you took was the Linux class or the Pro class?
Linux One class.
The Linux One class. Okay. What were you looking to get out of that class?
Well, basically, I was
and did it fulfill your needs.
I wanted to get some more information. Mandrake is really a GUI-based Linux distribution, and I wanted to learn more, and I felt I wasn't learning what I needed to learn just by doing what I wanted to do on Mandrake. So I took the Linux One class, hoping to get more information out of it, and I actually got a lot of information out of it. I learned a lot in that one class.
Well, what, in your opinion, was probably the most important thing that you picked up from that first class?
Well, I'd say I picked up basically the... It wasn't a class where you click this, click that, this is what you do. We learned the basics of how Linux works, how to install it, if something goes wrong, what to do. And Well, that's about it. It's it was in a small number of classes. It was a lot of information that we got, and it's been helpful ever since.
Okay. Oh, you caught me a little bit off guard for a second. Was there any specific aspect of the technology itself that was uncovered for you that would not have been picked up otherwise?
I'd say a lot of things. There was a lot of things that were covered. When I started with Mandrake, I did an install of a dual boot. I was running Windows 98 at the time. It installed without any problems, but that was it. I didn't learn anything else really from it. And by taking the class, I learned, you know, what you needed to know if you have a problem during the install, the basic way of how Linux works, and one of the important things from the class was not staying with the GUI front end, but learning to do things on the command line. And that's really the most important thing, because on Linux, if you stay on the graphical user interface, you're really not going to learn how the system works. The command line is very important to learn how to do things with that.
And you feel comfortable with that at this point?
Yes, I'm comfortable right now in the command line. I'm not an expert. I don't know everything, but I'm learning as I go.
Okay. You also took classes at Rate Intake, if I remember correctly. You took the Perl program over at TGX when we were there?
Yeah, I took the Perl 1 and I took the Unix 1.
Now, that's an interesting thing, because the Perl 1 class, or the Perl 2 class, it's hard for me. Ray said when he was here that he's going to try to take the admin classes first, and then he's going to take the programming classes, and we don't really advocate that method. We try to teach both. The reason we have felt that way is because I felt that it's really two sides of the same coin, that administration requires understanding of programming knowledge and vice versa. My question to you is, was your experience in learning the Perl programming language and programming in general, which is actually what the first class is just programming, learning how to program, and Perl is just an example language that's really being used for that purpose. Did you find that helped you understand the system and better as its goal was?
At the time that I took the Perl class, I think I had already taken the Unix 1 class, and I'd say the Perl is doesn't really have to do with the administration, so it's not a I don't think one is dependent on the other. You know, it's you're really talking about two different things between programming and administration.
Okay. Well, what was the benefits that you got out of the Perl class then? Did you take Perl 2 also?
No, I didn't follow up on that. I did buy the Perl programming book, and I have some other Perl books that I ended up getting afterwards. And the reason that I took the Perl class was because I plan on running a database for some of the things that I want to do, and the scripting language that I decided to use would be Perl. So that's the reason that I took the class. And you know, some things came up, and I needed to take a break, so I didn't follow up with the Perl 2 class.
Yes. Okay. Now, I think that was one of the interesting things about you, though, personally, is that first of all, how many people were in that Perl class over at TGIX or TGX, Charles Wells's place?
I think there was about eight people, I think it was.
That wasn't the class that had like 40 people in it?
The Perl 1?
Perl 1?
No.
Okay.
I,
There was one quest that was completely out of hand.
Oh, actually, yeah, we had problems with seats. There wasn't 40 people, though. I think there was about... That was a long table. I'd say it was probably about 16 people.
16 people. Yeah, I remember people sitting on the floor in that classroom. I should have broken that
down.
Yeah,
we didn't have enough seats.
It's okay. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about your experience that's different from a lot of other people's is you became vibrantly involved with the organization after taking the classes. So I'm wondering, what is it was the impetus for you for becoming as involved with the program as you know, as the NYLXS program, and how your how your involvement with the classes, that was the key touchstone for your greater involvement with the organization in general?
Well,
I guess the question is kind of loaded, because it's almost like you're asking, what is your history of the involvement of the NYLXS program, which, and how did that stem from the classes?
Well, what I did was I had taken... there was a free Linux class that was given by a local lug in the New York, New Jersey area. And I had actually showed up for some of those classes first, but it wasn't teaching me everything that I needed to learn. You know, I went to a few of the classes, and I knew that that program wasn't for me. Now, I had missed the first class, so I didn't hit the ground running, but that's when I tried NYLXS, and I basically took the first class to see what NYLXS was all about, because I had seen on the website all the other classes that were listed, and I said to myself, let me try to one class and we'll see how it works out, and if the classes are better, it's one thing to take a free class. If you get something out of it, great, but if you're not getting anything out of it and you find a class, even though the class costs money, it's well worth it. So I said, let me try it, and if I like it, there's going to be other classes that I could follow up with it. So I took the Linux One class, and I liked the instructor, which happened to be you, and I felt that I was really learning something there, and I also liked, like you said, there was Marco was in the class, Paul Rodriguez was in the class, there was a lot of people in the class that were part of the organization, or just becoming part of the organization, and I liked the people that were there, so I got more involved.
That's good. You know, none of those people were part of the organization prior to that, not even Marco.
I didn't know that, but actually Marco wasn't in the class, but
he was just kind of like observing it.
He was observing, and I have a tendency to do my own thing in class, and so
no.
I was doing an install actually before the rest of the class, and I had run into a problem, and instead of just, Marco came up next to me, and instead of just telling me how to fix something, he took the time to explain why I was having the problem, and we had a little back and forth, and just from that little interaction, it helped me a lot for while I was doing the install. If I have a failure, I know what to do, and so... He wasn't part of the class, or he wasn't, I don't know if he was part of the organization at the time, but he wasn't teaching the class, but he took the time to help me out on something that I was having a problem with.
Who was that, Paul or Marco?
Marco.
It was nice, and especially because that was a relatively large class, to have an extra person around.
Yeah, there was a lot of people in that class.
That was a formative class without question. The So you're saying basically one act of kindness by Marco basically hooked you into the program?
No, I wouldn't give him that much credit. It was a whole combination of things. It was I liked the group of people that were there. I found you to be an excellent instructor when it came to Linux. And, you know, I liked everything from the first class to the last class. I liked every single class, and I knew I was learning something there. And I had something to compare it with. I had a free class someplace else that I had taken, and it was the difference was night and day, the difference.
Well, I try to make sure everybody learns something. And I try to often teach people at their own level, which is sometimes problematic because sometimes the class lines are just being split between fast adopters and slow adopters. But so be it.
Well, I've observed a few of the other classes since then. I was just recently, the last board meeting that we had, that was a part of the that happened. Before the class, I stuck around, and that class worked out the same way. It was the same information there. Very knowledgeable teacher, which was you, and everybody was learning things there. And,
yeah.
I'd have to say that I took the class.
This previous class was a very satisfying class because they were really into it.
And about 15 months. 12 or 15 months ago, and I have to say, the class when I took it was great, and the classes that are being taught now, especially in the Linux One, and I'm sure the other classes also, now that you've had a year to polish off your teaching, I'm sure the classes are even better now than they were before.
So, let's look at a little bit of your involvement as you became a member of, or a further member of the organization. What was the first activities that you started becoming involved with outside the classroom?
Oh, I don't even remember. There's been so many things.
I think that the first time was actually when we moved classes to, when we moved classes into Asher's space.
Basically I helped out with the moving the furniture and getting the furniture.
Right. I mean, in fact, we could not have made that move of that stuff into that place without your help. I remember Marco saying that basically without your old van before, not the van, the truck before it was stolen, was available, we would not have been able to acquire that stuff. By the way, did you ever get reimbursed for those tables?
No,
What are you waiting for?
I have to find the bill. I'm terrible.
Just don't go to some mailing list like somebody else did and say that we failed to pay you because you forgot to submit it.
I'm terrible when it comes to receipts.
Well, if you can't give us find the bill, just give an estimate on the cost of what it was. So first you helped us move the stuff into Ashes, and then Paul Rodriguez pulled off that wonderful in-house program there when we opened up that, which, of course, didn't get as many students as we would have liked, although it was successful in-house. After that, then it's... Were you at the first business expo?
No, I missed the expos. I've had problems getting out, but I did help with the publicity on that.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And
I want to thank you for that because you've been extremely extremely good at getting the publicity up. It takes
right.
a little bit of persistence and get with it. Isn't this? By the way, that's one of the great things about you, and it's true about
that's
most
one of
the
organizations.
Our people don't sit. Everybody in our organization seems to have the same nervous twitch about standing around too long, you know.
Well, the thing is, when there's a lot of things going on with NYLXS that is interesting, and when you have things that are interesting, it's not something that you want to avoid. It's something that you want to pitch in and lend a hand, you know. You want to see the success, and you want to see, you know, this is something that it's not just something that you do as a hobby. It's it has to do with new, and it has to do with Linux, and it has to do with promoting it because you want it to succeed. And, you know, that's the whole motivation behind it. You want to expand the universe of Linux and
the greater world around it.
Yeah.
Did you make any of the in-services? At the
I,
Rose?
I made one. That was last summer, and it's been a while. I think the next business demo would... when is that next? The next business demo? It's going to be at Catherine Gibbs. Are we gonna do that?
Yeah, I hope that we do that. We're working on that right now. Actually, you emailed me about that, and we'll talk about that maybe this evening before you leave.
Right.
You at the Richard Stallman in service or the David Sugar in service when that we were?
No, I was at an earlier in service. I forgot who it was. It was somebody had done an in service on. I forgot what it was. It was one of the applications that they were knowledgeable on.
Was it Peter Norton giving it on?
No. Much earlier than that.
There was David Sugar on AutoConf. I gave one on GTK. There was Billy Donahue gave one on TCL and C. Marco gave one on the Blender.
I think it was before Marco did the Blender.
I'd have to go back and look at the archives. I don't remember. But okay. But at some point you drifted into the NY Fair Use activities. How did that happen?
I don't know if was involved before the thing that was happening in July, before the Commerce Committee hearing. Commerce Committee hearing may have been the. The beginning, the whole build-up to it may have been a few months before the Commerce Committee hearing. Basically, I think I was just laying back and seeing what I liked and what I could become involved in. And I think the build-up to the Commerce Committee hearing probably maybe around April going into May was probably when I first got involved with that.
Yeah, I was sort of looking at that point for an opportunity for exploiting it. They had the first Commerce Committee hearing, which had the right people in it that I wanted to crucify, but we didn't have enough notice or access. It wasn't until the second hearing came that
the
time was right.
First, the meeting was really under everybody's radar.
Yeah, it was too late, and even it wasn't actually under my radar, but it just was not. It was another mold whack. There was as it was given, it did not have the profile. I think that was necessary to bring it to the public's attention. I prepared to go to France. I remember that July. I went to France for NY Fair Use and did a speech there. And came back to New York. Of course, when I was in France, that's when it was sprung that we had this opportunity, so we tried to coordinate that as best as we could from Europe, and we came in. And at that point, you took a major initiative. What was the experience of organizing that on the New York side? What was happening with you guys?
Well, basically... a lot of people got involved with that. What I did was, as I was reading online what was being planned with that, and as it progressed, I saw that it was basically going to be an industry hearing, and this was going to be something that would be affecting all computer users. Not just it wasn't just going to be affecting Sony and AOL Time Warner. It was going to be affecting everybody who owns a computer. And so, as I was reading, I'm reading everybody who's going to be there: Sony, AOL, Time Warner,
all the heavy hitters in one place.
It was all big shots, and there was just. It was a few days of reading those web articles, what was going to be there, and then just something popped into my head, and I took a look who was going to be there, who was representing the public, and I only really found one person that was there representing the public. It was somebody from a consumer... digital rights organization, and I took a look at it, and I counted the number of people representing the big industry, and I came up with 15, and so it was one person representing the consumers, so I came up with 15-1. So when I saw that, it was 15-1. As soon as I came up with that 15-1, I made a web page, and at the top of the page I put 15-1 in large numbers, and then I put down basically made a summary of who was there representing big industry and who was there representing the consumers, and I sent that off to Broadband Reports. I sent it off to some of the other news organizations, and they picked up on it. I posted to some forums, and then we ended up putting that on the NY Fair Use website, and we built from there.
As I recall, originally that was actually not posted on the NYLX website, right? Or that was originally published on...
It was actually published on my on one of my websites, and I had used a... at that time, I'm not so great when it comes to HTML hand coding, so at that time I was using Dreamweaver and...
Shutter.
Yes. And that's during the times when Windows 98 wasn't crashing, because at that time I was still dual booting. And so I had made the web page with the Dreamweaver, and when we took a look at the code, it was in some of the other browsers, it was actually breaking because of some of the extensions that they put into the HTML code. It was causing problem with line breaks and some other HTML coding problems. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I was checking it on was Conqueror, because that's a web browser that I use, and it was okay in that, but it was breaking other browsers. So we cleaned up the code a bit, and it was placed on the NY Fair Use
Okay, how did the organization actually take place on the New York side of things? How did...
Well, a bunch of people, it was quite a few people got
involved.
Because
I was out of contact at first, right?
Right, and what happened was each person, what they did was they brought their strengths. And each person found something that they saw that they could do. And one thing that I saw that I could do was the publicity. And there were some other individuals, and each individual, somebody came up with the... credit card and the driver's license to drive us down. Somebody else was found out the hours when we could get the van. Somebody else was looking at the route that we were going to take to drive down. And some people were in contact with other individuals that were meeting us in Washington for the protest. And... let's see, there were quite a few other things. There was I had some websites that we were keeping track of for posting information, some boards, and like on Broadband Reports, I was posting on New York City, and Washington, D.C. simultaneously, so that if anybody either wanted to join us either in New York City or they wanted to join us down in Washington, D.C., we'd be able to accommodate them. So somebody else kept the running list of who would be able to go down to Washington, and we made sure that we were able to accommodate everybody in the van. And we had somebody, we had Richard Stallman met us in Washington, D.C., and we had some other individuals showed up. There was somebody that donated his services having to do with publicity in Washington, D.C., and there was a few other individuals. Somebody that was in charge of one of the blogs had put down a lot of information on the blogs and was forwarding that to other news sites. I was in contact with a few reporters that I was sending information to, and I was providing links to the information that we were listing on the NY Fair Use website. And then when we got down to Washington, we met people there, and one of the people that we met in Washington, besides Richard Stallman, there was somebody there who we didn't know, but he was somebody who was knowledgeable when it came to politics in Washington, and he gave us some pointers. That's on...
Let me let's step back just for a second. How organized were they before I got to New York?
Well, what I've been saying was that everybody pitched in, everybody found something that they could do, and there was a lot of people that were working on a lot of things, and I touched on some of the publicity that I did. Some of the somebody else was listing information on blogs. I was in touch with some of the reporters. Somebody organized the van.
Direction on it before I got that, or was it sort of like splattered around?
Well, there was a lot of ideas were being thrown in. You have to remember that the everybody was posting on the mailing lists. That we had made a special mailing list for the event, and everybody that was involved with that was posting on what they were going to do to help out to get down there, and then ideas were being thrown around as to what should be done when we were there, what should be done at the meeting itself, what should be done outside the meeting, or whatever, and you deserve some of the credit for really zeroing in on what needed to be done. And I think some of your emails from France helped with the direction as to what we needed to do. And so we kicked it around, and we decided on a strategy, and then we stuck to that strategy, which was the most important thing. I don't think holding stakes up... to get across the point to the stakeholders would have went over so well, they may not have let us in with raw steaks in our hands. But the important thing is that we stuck to our strategy, and we got their attention. Mm-hmm. They thought they were going to get this under the radar screen of everybody like they've been doing before, and they thought it was going to be a simple have a hearing and then passed the law saying that we had the passed the DRM restrictions, saying, listen, we had a hearing, nobody objected.
No. Where did the DRM
that you had produced? Theft, I believe that was one of your original slogans, and one of the other ideas that you had was that the DRM was called digital rights management by the industry, and it's not. It's a digital restrictions management is really what it is, and that's also something that you came up with. But the most important thing is the fact that we needed to get the point across where you came up with that we're the stakeholders, the public are the stakeholders. It's not the, it's not AOL Time Warner, and it's not Intel, and it's not Sony that is, or a news corporation that are the stakeholders. In Washington, when they invite the people that are affected by the legislation, when they invite them down there, right, when they invite them down there for hearings, they call these people stakeholders. When they're going to decide, for example, on some legislation to ban logging in forests, they call the logging company stakeholders, and they call the people that are in the environmental groups, they call them stakeholders. Now, in this, for this DRM hearings, they were calling Sony a stakeholder, and they were calling News Corporation a stakeholder, and AOL Time Warner, who, by the way, sent down a lobbyist, they didn't even send down an employee, they were calling them stakeholders, but there was no one there representing the public. It was one person from a small consumer organization, that was it.
So we devised the basic strategy, right, which was mostly based on my instruction from France. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's what it was. It's the trick and the lesson to be learned for doing something in Washington is that you have to zero in on what's going to be the most effective strategy, and you have to stick with that, and that's it. You know, you can't go down to Washington with a convoluted message. It has to be a clear message. It has to be something that people understand. And that's what we did. That's what we did. We went down there, and we got across that we're the public, we're the stakeholders, and we're not being represented on that panel.
That's good. And we basically stuck to that.
That was it. It was if we had...
We went down there pretty much with a clockwork plan at that point, which we stuck to.
It worked. The way that it came together was unbelievable. At the time, it didn't seem. It seemed like there was so many things going on. But the good thing about it was that each person found something to do, and they stuck with the one thing or the two things that they were going to do, and you brought everything together. You tied it. Were able to tie everything together, and that's how everything got done. It just fell into place. It's amazing how it did. There was just so many things to do to get down there, and it was such short notice of exactly what we needed to do. But in the end, it all just came together. Unbelievable.
That's good. Now, you know, this is not really so much to blow my own horn, but there has been questions recently about the leadership that was involved with, with NY30s and how things have happened. I'm happy to say, though, that we did very good down there, and it was important. And the reason why was because we kept a tight ship. We went down there with an explicit plan, with an explicit write-up for that plan. We executed that plan correctly, and everybody was a good soldier, and it's really important, regardless of who's leading, and if I wasn't the one leading, I would be glad to follow, and I've been in that situation where I felt. Actually, once we got into the meeting itself, it was really important to have tight control at that point, because we almost got ourselves kicked out, right? Maybe you'd like to go over that story.
Well, that was, first of all, that room was packed. It was, people had packed that room because they knew we were going to be there, and they knew we were going to have something to say. If they had known that as many people were going to show up, they would have held it in a bigger room. It was a standing room only, and I believe one reporter counted over 100 people in that room. And there was people standing for the entire, it was about a 4-hour meeting, there was people standing for the entire 4 hours. And they were crowding the door in the back, and that's basically it. It was they had everybody seated in this at this round table, or this U-shaped table, mm-hmm. where they had the big shots seated. All right.
We, at that particular junction, the meeting went on, right? And we pretty much worked the crowd before we got there, which was part of the plan. And we handed out material, right? And they, got fairly hissed, as I recall, from the audience at that particular junction at various times.
Well, what was going on was they had started the meeting, and from the beginning, the meeting was going over the technical aspects. First, the introductions were made over how the each of the representatives there, who they were, and which company they were representing, and so most of the companies there sent a somebody who works within the company. And the funny thing that one of the funny things that I noticed right from the beginning was that it wasn't 15 companies. One of the reporters had put the count at about 22 to 24 companies that were sitting at that table. And all the other companies, News Corp sent a representative, Intel sent a representative, Content Guard sent a representative. They were all representatives there that were employees of the company. AOL Time Warner didn't send an employee of the company. They sent a lobbyist. They had a lobbyist actually sitting there at the table. So that was one of the things that struck me as being a little out of whack. So they went the beginning of the meeting.
Right.
They had at the beginning of the meeting they did their intros, and then they started with all of the information for DRM, and they had the introduction from the Commerce Committee chairman. What was it? The chairman that was in charge of that hearing? Okay,
yeah,
it was a Commerce Committee chairman. And so he did his intro, and then everybody else introduced themselves, and then they started right away. I believe the guy from Content Guard, Myron something, was the one talking, and so they went over the all the different ways of instituting DRM, and they put up they had a chart. They were using one of those projectors, and they had listed about 20 or 25 companies that had come up with all types of DRM controls to be placed into computers or into files or into hard drives or into CD drives. And when he put the picture from the projector, when he put that up there showing all of the different controls and all of the different companies,
it was so ridiculous
that groans came from the audience when they saw it.
And these were the advocates for DRM at that point.
Right, and that was one of the hissing events, was because it was so ridiculous of all the different technologies that they were trying to put into the hardware and into the media to get us to put their own controls onto the files. So that was the beginning, and basically that's how it went. Each company put their 2 cents in as to what they were doing, and I'd have to say the there was a second person there that was supposedly representing the public, but he was really an employee of a company that makes some type of media devices for that they encourage open standards so that they can sell their devices. But the one guy that was there that was representing the media from, what was the name of the company that you said? The name of the organization that was representing?
It was Digital.
Digital.
Something, Digital Rights, something or other. I
okay, well, that guy was pretty quiet. He didn't go into too much detail, or he wasn't too explicit as to what he was doing. I would have to say, out of all the people there, the guy from Philips...
He was probably
the best advocate for the consumers, because Philips is wants to make the hardware.
Not only that, but he's
and they want to be able to sell hardware.
He's the only Orthodox Jew at the table.
Okay, that may have something to do with it. I'm not an expert in that area, but...
Let me ask a question. At what point was it that you stood up and barked at them? What point was that?
Well, basically... This is the point that I was leading to. It was they had gone around the table. I'd say they'd gone around the table for the intros, and they'd gone around the table for the technology for what they were doing for a DRM. And I think they had gone around the table a second time. And at that point, they had started summarizing what was happening that day. And the one of the amazing things that was happening was...
Well, I think what keyed you off was actually he made the statement, and it looks like we now have input from all of the...
From all
the stakeholders, and I think that's when you stood up and said, but what about the public?
No. What happened was the... The lobbyist from All Time Warner had made some statements that were factually incorrect. She had attempted to put a summary of the hearing that was happening that day, which was incorrect. She had said that basically everybody was in agreement and basically legislation.
That was, yes, that's right. I remember that.
And then right after her, Jack Valenti piped in, and he basically mimicked what the lobbyist from All Time Warner was saying, and then he went on to say that everybody sitting here at the table is in agreement that what's happening now is not working, we need legislation, and... So he was saying that we are all in agreement, and
he actually threatened the committee. He said to the committee that if this committee can't get DRM enacted, then they'll have to go to Congress to do it.
Right. That was one of his statements. But the statement that really got to me was that he was what I understood at that time, and I understood later, was he was making a statement that the senators and the congressmen would be able to read later on the floor when they were making these votes that a hearing was held and everybody was in agreement and nobody disagreed, and that's why they voted for the legislation. So he was making a statement that everybody here is in agreement and everybody here is all represented. He was making a statement somewhere along those lines, and I couldn't take it anymore. So I stood up and said,
"What about the public?"
That's it. I said, "What about the public?"
Mm-hmm.
And
at that point, okay, so that was a pretty critical point, because although it was very effective, we almost got tossed at that point. So what happened?
Well, the thing was that Jack Valenti was saying that everybody's here, everybody's represented, and everybody's in agreement. And I was disagreeing with that, so I stood up and I said, "What about the public?" And at that point, nobody was expecting me to stand up, so I think I shocked some people that were in the room that they weren't expecting that. And
The public actually spoke. Imagine that.
The thing was that everything that Jack Valenti had said, it was like it was running, it was playing back in my mind as I was standing up. So remembering what I said later was one thing, but just everything flowed out of my mouth because from what he was saying, it wasn't accurate. So everything just flowed out of my mouth. I said, what about the public? The public is not being represented. And there was so many things that I went over saying that the public is not represented with the stakeholders. It's industry that's sitting up here at the table, and you're making this legislation without the public input. And nobody was expecting me to stand up, and most of all, Jack Valenti was a little flustered at when I stood up. And so as I was making the statement, Jack Valenti was saying something about being interrupted, and at the same time the Commerce Committee chairman was telling me to sit down, and he was basically trying to shut me up. And well, what happened was that Jack saw that there was a problem because people were speaking up, and the press was there. The press was taking pictures. There was as I was standing up, there was a reporter there from I believe Declan McCullough was one of the guys that was taking the pictures. He's a reporter now for CNET. And so Jack saw that the meeting wasn't going according to his plans and that the press was watching. And so what happened was Jack said to me that if I would down and let him finish, he would give me a chance to respond. So I said, okay, fine. So I sat down, and Jack Valenti actually had the nerve to say after that we're the public, were his words. I'm the public, you're the public, and he was addressing the chairman of the committee. He turned to his left, and he addressed who was the guy in that Intel got into the argument with in the beginning?
I don't remember what his name was. Their names didn't matter to me. They were just faceless. I believe faceless it was as far as I was concerned.
Who sent the letters to each other? It was Intel and
I don't remember. It might have been Microsoft and Jack Valenti.
Yeah, Microsoft it was. Okay, so Jack Valenti turned to the guy from Microsoft and said, "You're the public." He turned to the guy, the committee chairman, and he said, "You're the public." And he said as himself, "I'm the public." So basically, according to the world that Jack Valenti lives in, Jack Valenti, the
okay, but how come we didn't get tossed out?
Well, basically, the press was there.
You think that's the reason we didn't get tossed out?
Well, if the press wasn't there, I think we all would have been arrested.
Okay.
But anyway, so
I think
Jack,
we didn't get tossed out because when we pushed the line as far as we could push it, we retreated long enough for them to give an excuse not to throw us out.
We sat down. We were asked to sit down, and I did sit down. And Jack Valenti said that if I gave him a chance to finish, he would give me a chance to respond.
Actually, you continued standing at that point, but which was fine. But that's in fact, there's that picture of me standing, you standing, and Richard standing.
No. I sat down.
Oh, first you sat down, then you stood
back. I sat down. And then, as Jack finished talking, I didn't give him a chance to ask me to stand up because I didn't think that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as he finished talking, I stood back up.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I had you had asked me before I stood up to let's try and get a Richard Stallman to
do the speaking,
to give him the floor. So at that time when I stood back up, I had mentioned, I again went into the fact that the public wasn't being represented, and that the public are the stakeholders, and that it was important for the public to be heard at this hearing. And then I turned to my left, and at that time, when I had stood up the second time, is when you stood up, and one or two other people also stood up.
Actually, and it was me, you, and Richard at that point.
No, Richard never stood up.
No, Richard was standing.
Okay.
Richard was standing. Well, let me tell you, remember
but
what happened.
Anyway, I turned
we almost
had
a meltdown at a particular point because we almost got into a tit-for-tat with the chairman. So at that point, I tried to regain control of the situation, and you were accommodating to take direction on that. And I asked them to let Richard – you asked them to let Richard talk, and then they rejected that. And at that point, I stood up and said, look, you guys wanted – you said you claimed that you wanted to have the computing industry talk, and you think you have the computing industry represented here, but the brightest person in the computing industry is sitting to my left over here, and now you won't let him talk. So how are you even claiming, let alone you have the public speaking, but you don't even have the computing industry here represented?
That's, you got a good memory. I remember you saying that.
And at that point, he then said, now the reason why I did this was two reasons. First of all, we were almost got ourselves canned, and I didn't want to get canned because I wanted to stay in the room. Another reason was because I wanted to see if I could get Richard to talk, because they didn't know who the FSF was, which was really astonishing, actually, when you think about it. So at that point, we managed not to get ourselves interrupted because there was leadership talking to leadership at that particular point, and it did not melt down to total chaos, which is, I'm sorry, but that's the point I'm trying to basically drive down to. We would not have been able to pull off as many things as we did anywhere through this effort if we didn't have strong leadership and people willing to follow the direction of it. And we did a really good job because of that. And it's a good case study in how to do proper advocacy and how to push the line, know when to stop, and how strong organization, a clear message, can have good results. And so I hope I don't run over your toes in this. I wanted to tell you that I was really impressed that day with yourself in particular and other people that were there, and never got a chance to really thank you for the efforts that you went through. I know you went through hell and high water that day. The only thing that was a little bit disappointing with that day was, first of all, when we came back downstairs, we were still at the press conference, and then nobody wanted to let the press conference go. And we basically broke down our organization at that point. They felt, okay, well, we had a great time. We, you know, what's the expression for it? We shot our load, right, and it was over, and it wasn't over. There was yet a whole battle to be fought with for the press and so on that was not being adequately. And also the other thing was, I was very upset that not everybody actually drove down, all the people that came with us actually drove down in the van with us together, and that fractionism later exposed itself as a further weakness, which had prevented us from capitalizing this as much as I would have liked to have seen. And you're welcome to comment or not. You'll pass?
I was just surprised. I expected everybody to come down in the van, and I guess I figured something was up when that didn't happen.
Right, and that won't happen ever again under this organization. We go down as a group. We go in prepped. We execute properly, and that's the way it's done.
Right.
Unfortunately, you lose some people because everybody wants to be the big mocker and so on, but which is in Yiddish meaning the big boss. But
well, what happened on at that meeting is I guess a good model to follow. You know, that's basically everything came together, and we set out.
We should probably write that up as a how-to. You know what?
Maybe that
might be a good article for the next Linux Journal. Okay, Vinny, I just want to say
find somebody to write it.
yeah, somebody besides me. Okay,
somebody besides me.
Vinny, I want to tell you that thank you very much for, first of all, for making it out to Brooklyn today and for being on our show. I'm glad that you got not only an important computing education from the Free Software Institute, but it also has spurred you on to become involved in the in the community in a very positive fashion in its own right. People who have not met Mr. Vinny and has not had the pleasure of dealing with him, he's a very formal person to have on your side of the debate, whatever the debate is. He's meticulous, persistent, and he doesn't let go. So, these are all the good things about these are all the best qualities to have in this game.
On that note, I just want to get one more thing in, because tomorrow is going to be another action event for NYLXS, and one of the things that's happening tomorrow is going to be having to do with Microsoft showing up at a open source event, and something that I haven't seen discussed anywhere is the fact that Microsoft is pushing their so-called shared source program as something that's competing with open source, or something that gives them a footing into the open source movement. And the one observation that I wanted to make, because this may turn out to actually have some basis in fact later on, is my question is, if the shared source cannot be modified,
what's the point?
And this is a question that I'm going to pose to you, and I'd like to have your reaction on it. If the shared source cannot be modified, how do we know that Microsoft is actually showing us the source?
Well, there's two issues, actually, right? I mean,
because they can show us anything.
They can show us anything.
If you can't modify it, how do you know it's really the source?
Yeah. Now, mind you, this is a slightly different issue than the one that we're actually going down to tackle. The issue that we're trying to tackle down there is fair representation of free software at free software events. Even if the e-government OS was not important in its own right, which I believe that is fairly important, especially in these recessionary times, the question is, why are they getting a free pass in the first place? We have, and not just at eGov, but in all these events, they just like steamrolled their way in. It's like they invited themselves to the table. They bullied themselves to the table. They haven't contributed anything to either the community or to the source code base. So they've done neither, all right? And they've tried to undermine us in every event, which makes them our competitive. They put themselves in a world of collaborative competition, which is what free software is—a competition of collaboration among individuals to see what we can do. They come across with clearly as advocates against that in every way that you can imagine. And so, why are we, for God's sakes, we have children that we have to feed. It's enough to compete with them in the market when they have all these anti-competitive things that they are pulling in the first place, let alone letting them at our table. Even if they're speaking for a minute, it's a minute too much, let alone that they should be allowed to walk away with prizes at the Linux World Expo for things that they made in an uncompetitive fashion, in a non open source way, or for that matter, in a non-free software way. It can't continue. So we're not just trying to kick eGov and pick on poor Bruce Perens and Tony Stanko, but we want to set off a warning shot for all of these conferences that this is not going to continue without a grassroots swelling from within the free software movement to fight this unfair representation by Microsoft in our areas where we're trying to bring our own goods and services to the table to make money. Damn it, I need to make money, and I don't need to share the spotlight with Microsoft.
Well, these are issues that, to I'm sure us and to I'm sure a lot of other people, matter. But for some people in government and some people in private industry, they could care less. It's a matter of they're being directed to take a look at open source for either financial reasons or security reasons or for other reasons. And now they have an out by being able to say that, listen, Microsoft is sharing their source code. And so I'm complying by because of this, and Microsoft is saying, listen, we're sharing our source code, so you're not really getting any additional benefit according to their point of view. But basically,
actually, they're saying is that this is they're saying that this is they're actually saying this is a trip into the middle by them sharing their source code. This is a move by Microsoft to the middle, and of course, the point that you're making establishes clearly that it's not into the middle. First of all, just because they think that that's the middle doesn't make it the middle. The middle is free software. Free software sits in the middle, not at the extreme end. What it says is that human beings that create and collaborate with something can be free to interact with each other and with these systems, which we own, they're our property, in a way that doesn't impede the natural growth of human development. Right? That's a middle.
Right. Well,
that's a middle. That is
that
the middle. That is Apple Pie, Chevrolet, and baseball.
Right.
I mean,
well,
that is in the middle. So what Microsoft is saying is let's shift the middle to an extreme, all right? So Microsoft is going from one extreme position to a slightly more extreme position because now they're saying, okay, we'll give you the source code, but you're not sure if it's really the source code because you can't compile it. It's not like you can take it and compile it and check it against the real Windows system. So what are they giving you?
Right.
They can be completely lying to you.
Right.
And in addition, as you pointed out, not only can they be completely lying to you, but who cares anyway? You know, it's not like it really is a collaborative effort or that anybody has rights to hack it, including the government. And you're still beholden to them for every single change, which is as unmiddle and as anti-competitive as you can get. And it's just not acceptable. And does that answer your question?
Well, I'm just... the question, yeah, I'm just making the point that it's the advocacy of open source is... I don't think Microsoft is looking to co-opt the advocacy. What they're looking to do is they're looking to slam the brakes on governments that are insisting on using open source, or they're trying to open a door where they can say, listen, we have shared source so you can continue using our product.
Yeah, and no matter how many, and people think that you can argue with them about it, and that's good, but they bring their own, they are the 300-pound gorilla, and they bring their own press. And if you think that you can debate with them and you're going to get a fair reporting, think again. That's not
right,
going to happen.
Which is the whole problem of what's happening tomorrow.
That is. That's the whole problem. And that is what we're going to start to bang on. We've got to make the people that run these events to start to become responsible to the free software people that are holding them. And Bruce Perens actually had the goal to say, well, he thinks that most people would be in agreement of allowing them there. What did he do? Did he poll them? First of all, he represents a very small community of developer base and not the user base at all in the Debian project. And he doesn't represent the huge user base whatsoever in any way. And Bruce can probably do some good work in the future, but in this particular issue, he's on the wrong side of the issue. And Tony Stanko's got no excuse. Tony's got absolutely... There's nothing to say for Tony in terms of this. There really should be an investigation. We should be demanding an investigation. And this will continue. In fact... Not just in the federal government, but as soon as we get back to New York, hopefully next week before we have to return our uniforms, hopefully we'll be also hitting the New York City government with this, which is something I haven't sprung on people yet, but they don't know. We have a week for these costumes. I'd like to bring it to City Hall before that time is done.
Well, I think City Hall will be another action that we'll see some widespread involvement by NYLXS.
I hope so.
Quite a this
and Y Fair Use. Let's not forget Y Fair Use.
There's quite a.
Let me just read the pamphlet that we're giving out tomorrow. It says, "Beware the false advocate or the false advocate. I'm trying very hard to get rid of my lazy L's, which I can hear now when I listen to the radio show." Okay. Beware the false advocate. Think of these things. From whence you come, where you are going, and to whom you must account. Ben Franklin's Poor Richard Almanac. I'd like to make a comment that's actually from the Jewish Talmud, but okay. As this conference begins, we, the representative of NYLXS in New York as a fair use, want you to know that the organizations do not represent the free software movement. Although nominally described as an event wherein the representatives of municipal, provincial, and national governments can share their experiences with open source software and to learn about new offerings and best practices, in truth, this noble purpose has been corrupted by those who would seek to gain personal and political advantage. Few people have virtue to withstand the highest bidder, George Washington's quote. The sponsors of this gathering in the person of the representatives of Tony Stenko, ESQ, have elected to include participants who are neither produce open source software nor support it. In fact, these organizations are actively opposed to free and open source software as it threatens to archaic structures upon which their criminal businesses are based. Any free-thinking individual can know in advance what their message will be, so why must we suffer their appearance today? Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. John Adams. By application of our faculties of reason, we conclude that Mr. Stenko is using this conference to advance his personal and political ambitions, applying careful reinterpretation of the guidelines he himself laid forth to violate the spirit, if not the letter, of free and open source software. In the process, he robs those who would otherwise represent themselves and their work admirably for the benefit of all present, and give both aid and advantage to those who would deprive us of our freedoms. When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one an unpitied sacrifice on the contemptible struggle. Edward Burke, Thoughts on the Cause of the Present Discontent. No business is guaranteed the right to survive if its offerings are harmful or outdated. NYLXS is obligated as a community of developers and technicians on the forefront of this coming economic revolution to stand up, demand accountability, and represent the truth. Free and open source software is the only responsible choice for openness, standards compliance, and accountability in government. Join us in demanding higher standards from those who wrap themselves in the banner of our liberty. Do not tread on free software. And on that note, I'd like to say goodnight to everybody. This has been a little bit of a longer show, and we're getting better at this, and we will see you again somewhere around 8 o'clock next Friday for the next www.nylxs.com radio show. And have a pleasant good night.